are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, February 13th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Eric Blanc, the Jacobin, on why single-payer healthcare is the best strategy for unions in America and the ongoing strikes and uprisings in France as we head into the Nevada contest. Bernie Sanders making the strong case for single payer, even as he finally calls James Carville a political hack and takes on Mayo Pete. Mike Bloomberg. It's Donald Trump isn't the only late Roman scenario, folks. Mike Bloomberg is destroying democracy. And he's hiring so many operatives at state and local level that he is literally starving the progressive infrastructure of the country. He'll also lose to Donald Trump. Amy Klobuchar, biggest backer, Cargill, is the cause of any number of anti-union and public health crises in this country. Donald Trump's approval ratings remain unchanged after his impeachment acquittal, and eight Republicans do say, apparently they will vote to limit Trump's ability to attack Iran as Ilhan Omar unveils a new, quote-unquote, progressive baseline in foreign policy. The new Trump budget has major cuts to Social Security and Medicare and other vital social programs. Bill Barr will reappear in front of a House committee after the very controversial slash authoritarian intervention in the Roger Stone sentencing. And teachers in Colombia announce a two-day strike to defend the right to live as President Lula is received by Pope Francis. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Folks, we will also unveil a new character in the later half of the show. Where is Nelson Mandela gone now? See, the type of person that would say, I don't like that tweet. I abandon the ANC.
He's always evolving.
I wanted to fight against apartheid, but then there was a Bernie bro with 20 followers who tweeted something.
We don't know how he would be if he existed in a world with the pig pooping on its own balls meme.
When I saw the pig pooping on its own balls meme, it was clear that we needed to stop our struggle.
We'll get to all of this nonsense about, you know, the next wave of the melodrama about Bernie Twitter. But 99.99999% of it is disingenuous, dishonest, delusional, insane, and manufactured. But to the extent it's real, I mean, I really would invite folks to really, you know, really ask yourself if voting against a single payer and defeating Trump is something that you would reverse because of, like, I don't know, you didn't like some Chapo meme or something. I think I would invite you to reflect.
There are really people who think that way.
And that is something that should be psychologically
It's probably
studied.
More now that the candidates are feeding that narrative.
Right. Now that there's a bunch of candidates who are just like, I used to be with Bernie, but then I saw somebody post a blue balls meme.
I know one. She's like my pet, that kind of person. I don't know what we call them. But she did eventually come around to Bernie, partly as a result of friends like me who were very patient with her and not mean. So it can be done.
Well, Okay, that's awesome. And of course, you should always try to treat everybody should try to treat their fellow humans well. As in, I emphasize everybody, as distinct from disingenuous, dishonest, demented campaign
narratives. But particularly those who are engaged in politics on a non-professional level.
Like, yeah.
Don't be mean to those people.
That's
unless
right.
they're fascists.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's just a regular-ass person.
So that being said, I mean, I think we can all agree that we need to have unity at all costs, obviously. So, and because of the sort of whining from various candidates about people engaging in politics, I have really rethought. When I first saw this moment, I thought that this was a brave stand for democracy, because Mike Bloomberg, people need to be really clear. It is not just that he has an absolutely appalling record on every single measurable issue you can imagine. It is that his intervention and buying of the process is the next step if this is comes to fruition. First of all, he'll lose to Trump in a landslide. Secondly, it is the formalization. We've known that democracy is in sick and in trouble. Bloomberg's a nominee. We need to rethink where we are. We're done. And we need to have an actual conversation about democracy and norms, not a real I like the West Wing and I'm freaked out by Trump one, but a real one. You have to understand the difference between even an appalling candidate like Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton and the contradictions that they represent versus the unmitigated representation of plutocracy buying its way into the electoral form. That all being said, so I thought that this protest video we're about to see was awesome. But again, after some whining from some of the candidates and their surrogates, we might have a different thought on it. But you're going to need to make, you know, take this, check this out on your own.
Check out this Bernie bro.
This happened yesterday. Here was a Bernie bro at a Bloomberg rally in Chattanooga, Tennessee. This Bernie bro got very divisive.
Our breath. I am that excited.
It's also divisive that they cut her mic, though, too, to be fair.
I mean, that is true. There's a lot of division.
A lot of division going on. Let's just play this again.
Yeah.
My breath. I am that excited.
That is not democracy. That is plutocracy.
And divisive that they boo her, too.
Whoa, they're booing her. That's also, I don't think that that's unity.
Who are these cucks who like Bloomberg?
I hope they're being paid.
Yeah, probably a good chunk of them are.
Yeah,
paid. I mean, they're just rich authoritarian liberals,
or they're rich authoritarian liberals.
Who is so that guy? That's, who
no, but I can't believe it. I mean, I've been hearing that you aren't supposed to tweet a joke at major news personalities, or you know, God forbid, to ask them to correct their lies or defamatory statements. I thought we were up past all of that. I thought we were supposed to have a unity campaign. So obviously that aggressive Bernie bro that you saw just
Bernie should call out that woman.
Yeah, Bernie should call out that woman. Absolutely. That's number one. That's the most important thing that needs to happen in the campaign right now. But then they booed her protest. So it's all just very non-unity based and divisive. It's almost like we're running in a primary. So Mike Bloomberg can destroy any last vestige of credibility of the Democratic Party, of the news media, of political leadership across the board, of the broad center left in this country. And we'll get to this terrifying report that Ryan Grimm did on how he's buying off talent across the country, which speaks to broader structural problems. That's all going to happen. Don't for a second blame people who say they are not able to vote for a oligarch stop and frisk mayor. I'm not even going to entertain that whining and conversation.
It's like we're instead of doing this thing that might have a chance to beat Trump, we're going to instead try to fly over the Atlantic in a air balloon made out of cotton candy. Please get on, or you don't really care about
right.
Disney.
It's
not going to happen, guys.
It's not going to happen.
Got to draw the line somewhere.
If you do that, you go do that. So And let's just be really clear. If you Mike Bloomberg's going to go to Wisconsin and say, I'm richer than Donald Trump and I'm going to take away your e-cigarette. If you think that that's a winning strategy, then more power to you. And I really hope you're getting compensated to be so delusional. Donald Trump has not had strong material like this since the halcyon days of the Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush era. Here he is this morning. Mini Mike Bloomberg is a loser, all capital, who has money but can't debate and has zero presence. By the way, this is why they are hiding him and have him so tightly choreographed, because they know that Mike Bloomberg is immensely unlikable and repulsive to anybody he isn't paying. He reminds me of a tiny version of Jeb, quote-unquote, low-energy Bush. But Jeb has more political skill and has treated the black community much better than many, two exclamation points. And there's a serious point here. For people who haven't been paying attention, and at some point you have to start thinking strategically about Donald Trump. Yes, Donald Trump is obscene. Yes, he is disgusting. Yes, it's a threat to democracy with him and Bill Burr.
Yes, he's hypocritical.
Yes, he's – wow. Yeah. Whoa. No, actually, keep emphasizing that one. That would be a really political killer. Okay. Yes, he's a racist. But – starting with his Super Bowl ad, Donald Trump is running a very, very, very clear and conscious campaign to get a couple of percentage points from the African-American voters, which is all he needs. That's all he needs. If he flips 2-3%, he wins. And you're going to run him, somebody against him who absolutely he can pummel. Now, by the way, I think, frankly, there's some of the dynamic here with how overt and insane Bloomberg's racism. I think there's some dynamic where I've talked to some people, you know, some black friends, frankly, who are just like, yeah, duh. A lot of white politicians are like this. He just says it, right? And I think there's some element of like, you know, the white liberal folks are more shocked by this. But the bottom line is that, first of all, we all need to be shocked by this. And secondly, okay, all you need to do is pull 2-3 percentage points, and Donald Trump can dine off of clips like this.
From stop and frisk to fingerprinting, Mayor Bloomberg's latest crime-fighting idea has a lot of people angry tonight. The mayor wants to fingerprint more than 600,000 people who live in public housing.
What we really should have is fingerprinting to get in. And of course, since lots of there's an allegation that some of these apartments aren't occupied by the people who originally have the lease.
That's like invasion of somebody's privacy or something. Why do you want to fingerprint somebody? It's bad enough when you get arrested, you get fingerprinted.
Why? For what? We live here. What? All these years, this is not jail.
You want to prove you live here? All you got to do is ask to see the lease. Well, I don't think it's right. So Bloomberg needs to stop his mess.
This is a you know, we talk about pilot programs of authoritarianism. Bloomberg did that on the people of color of New York City. I mean, be very clear about that. He went further in some key areas than the Trump administration has been able to do. And look, maybe ICE under Bloomberg will do some, you know, emotional sensitivity trainings and ask people their preferred pronoun or something. But if you think there's going to be any structural change from a man who justified spying on college students' whitewater rafting trips, you're out of your mind.
Or on the take.
Yeah.
Or on the take.
He's also said a lot of incredibly sexist things that put grab him by the pussy to shame. I mean, someone named Sarah in NY has a whole tweet thread about all the sexist, misogynistic, and rape apologia statements that have come out of that guy's mouth. And if you think that Trump won't try to weaponize that against him, you're crazy. Like, Trump runs on liberal hypocrisy.
Exactly. And it would work better because Republicans don't care about that, and Democrats, I guess, do. I mean, yeah.
Well, again, we also see how cynical that, you know, right? Like, how many people who for the last, you know, like, I want an intersectional body language expert to look at micro expressions on Bernie's face when he condemned police violence are going to go like, yeah, he apologized. Yeah. Nah, take a scan of the retina. What are you going to do? He's a Republican.
Showing your asses.
All right. Okay. Today's show is brought to you by third love. I know everybody loves when Sam's reads these ads. Designed with measurements for millions of women, Third Love's bra styles are made to fit your life. They have over 80 bra sizes. But know that only one. But know that the only one that matters is yours. We have a testimonial here. I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two and both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring. But not as boring as t-shirt bras. Subtle cute details, so I don't feel basic. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own, with straps that won't slip, tagless labels, lightweight memory foam cups to mold to your shape. Plus, returns and exchange are free and easy. In fact, Third Love's perfect fit promise: every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, and put it to the test. And if you don't love it, return it to Third Love, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows that it's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering our listeners 50% off your first 15. Sorry. Third Love knows that a perfect bra for every knows that there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find a perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off. And the makers of Quip Electric Toothbrush want you to know that the single discovery that matters most for your dental health, for your dental health care, if you have good habits, you are good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day, flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulse to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. The best part is that Quip delivers fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. Join over 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And I've been on the Quip train for over a year. I love the timer, so I know exactly that 2 minutes. It's very satisfying. It makes you feel like you've accomplished two goals in the day. And if you go to quip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill free. That's a first refill free at quip.com/majority. Go to GETQUIP.com/majority. Quip, the Good Habits Company. We'll be right back with Eric Blanc.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Eric Blanc. He is the author of Red State Revolt. He's also a national surrogate for Bernie Sanders for president. Eric, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. So, Eric, protests and strikes are ongoing in France, and particularly in this, you know, authoritarian Mike Bloomberg moment, it's helpful for us probably to think about Emmanuel Macron. What's been happening there? We've covered that a bit on the show, but take us through it. What are the strikes about? What's at stake? And how are they ongoing?
Right. The best way to think about what's going on in France is imagine what would happen if we elected Pete Buttigieg to the United States. Basically, you have a billionaire bot, so-called centrist, who once in office has basically made it his single-handed mission to roll back the most important gains of the welfare state in France, one really since World War II. You know, some of your listeners might know that France, because of a really strong labor movement, has one of the best pension systems, best social security systems in the world. And it's precisely because of that that the capitalist class, through the mechanism of this centrist government, so-called, is trying to roll back these gains, the pensions. Specifically, the proposal that Macron is trying to push through and which has been debated in Parliament and that in March and February is going to get potentially voted on, the proposal would basically make it so you have to work longer and that you're going to get less in pensions when you retire. It destabilized the current system, and it puts France in a system much more resembling the United States. And so because of that, there's just been a dramatic explosion of class struggle from below. You've seen actually the longest strike in the history of modern France. Really, since last November, there's been strike after strike after strike, particularly in rail and in the public transportation system, but in the private sector as well, teachers, garbage collectors just recently, there's been general strike after general strike after general strike. And the amazing thing about the movement is that despite the disruption it's caused, not only for capitalists, but really for, you know, the population as a whole, because when you shut down a city, it's not easy to get things done. Despite that, support is overwhelming still on the side of the workers. So the struggle remains very fluid, and it's going to be, up to workers to continue to put pressure to try to make the government cede.
What can we say and learn about, we don't want to go into these, you know, essentialist arguments, but it seems to me that, and certainly, I mean, that's what your book is about. There's strikes, there's uprisings happening across the United States. There's, I think people increasingly recognize that there really does need to be a politics that is synchronized with electoral forces, but can exist outside of them and can mobilize people for a variety of different reasons and contexts. But it does seem like, I mean, France does have this relatively unique commitment, certainly in Europe and certainly compared to the United States. It makes it seem more analogous to what we're seeing in Chile or Ecuador or Haiti. What is it in that political culture? Is it just the ongoing strength of labor? Is it that there is a relatively developed class consciousness there? I mean, what can we learn so we aren't just looking at them going like, man, every time they threaten to take away those people's baguettes, they really go for it.
Yeah, I mean, those baguettes are pretty dope, to be honest. Good. But it's not really the explanation. I think, you know, this is, as you mentioned, the stereotype of France. You know, people always say, oh, the French, they're just striking again. And there is something to it. I do think that the level of class solidarity is higher. But rather than look at that as a product of, like, some sort of essential cultural trait, I think it's the opposite, is that actually that solidarity and that cultural trait has been forged politically by a strong labor movement. And so there's no real reason to think that that type of culture of solidarity can't be forged elsewhere. In fact, in many places in the world, it existed and was the norm. Even in the United States, you know, if you were living in a union town up and through the 70s, you had this sense, really, that you were in it together, an injury to one is an injury to all. So that type of solidarity born from strong unions, strong working class parties, that really permeates a community so that you have local union halls, that you really feel part of something bigger than yourself, that's really what has been born, has been really broken down since neoliberalism in the 80s, 90s, and since. And in France, I think part of what you're seeing right now is that process of rolling back union strength just hasn't gone as far. And so one of the consequences of that is that there is still enough of this legacy of understanding that we are part of a class that is against a tiny minority of society that is exploiting us, and that when some of our brothers and sisters go on strike, they're not doing that for selfish reasons, no matter what the media says. They're actually doing it for all of us. And so I find it very hopeful, because what you see then in France is what we should aspire to as well. And it's what I think is amazing about these teacher strikes. You see it even in a red state, there where you wouldn't expect there to be, you know, anything resembling something like French levels of class solidarity. But in the process of the strike itself, the strike produced a sense that we're in it together, that we're united, and that we have common interests against the tiny minority that rules society. So I'm actually pretty optimistic that the French type of social struggle, you can see that percolating, as you mentioned, across the world. And there's no reason to think that you can't see that in the United States as well.
Give us one of those red state examples that you think really exemplifies that.
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me in early 2018, you know, where would you least expect there to be a successful statewide strike, I would have put Oklahoma and Arizona at the top of my list. You know, bonkers. If you really think what happened, it's really, really remarkable that not only did you have strikes, but they were statewide and successful in some of the most, you know, so-called conservative states in the country. West Virginia, we can bracket because West Virginia actually does have more of a labor tradition, but there's not a strong living labor tradition in Oklahoma and Arizona. And nevertheless, what you saw in early 2018 is literally hundreds of thousands of workers, most of whom had not been part of the union, most of whom had never been part of a strike, shut down their states, their public education system, paralyzing and creating a social crisis for literally millions of students and parents, and forcing Republican governments to cede to their demands. And those strikes were overwhelmingly supported by the population. You're talking 75%, 80% public support for these strikes, even though the majority of people in the, you know, in the education and in the state were either, were not, you know, quote unquote liberals. These were people who were maybe just checked out of politics, might have voted for Trump. About half of the union members and half of the teachers had voted for Trump. And nevertheless, because when struggle happens, you learn very quickly, they were able to see through the process of struggle, through the process of organizing, who was actually on their side and who wasn't. So you had a lot of educators I spoke with said, you know, I voted for Trump, I thought we needed some change, and that didn't stop me from going on strike against this Republican governor, whether it was Oklahoma or Arizona. So I do think that part of the difficulty is just when you don't have a political working class alternative presented, people check out of politics. But when you do have real a mass viable alternative, you know, the types of folks that we often dismiss, I think are generally smart and rational, and will seize that opportunity. And I think that should give us a lot of, you know, optimism about the potential for class conflict and class organization in the United States, even where you might least expect it.
Definitely. So we're going to get to single payer and why that's actually not only going to be good for everybody, it's actually profoundly strategically important for rebuilding the union movement in the United States. But before that, I mean, you're somebody in the campaign. I think big picture, I mean, it shouldn't be lost that Bernie Sanders is, you know, basically is taking on literally everybody in every type of discredited establishment imaginable. And he won Iowa and he won New Hampshire. He's heading into Nevada looking really strong. He's heading into South Carolina, you know, looking actually increasingly strong, and his national numbers are starting to move absolutely in the right direction. So I want people to feel the accomplishment, the strength, the optimism, the momentum of that's undeniable. And Bernie Sanders is, in fact, if we're speaking in terms of reality, he is the front runner. He's also the one who does the best against Donald Trump in most polls. Now, that being said, you know, there hasn't been a radical increase in turnout so far. The margins have been really tight. And, you know, we know that there's, you know, all sorts of potential games and fuckery, excuse my language, that could take place. And, you know, unless it's, you know, aimed at Bernie, unless there's more sort of points on the board. So can you just give us your thoughts as somebody connected with the campaign, but obviously with your own analysis about where we are and what the state of play looks like moving forward?
Yeah, I think the first point you made is really the essential one to foreground, which is, it's really remarkable that you have a democratic socialist who's going up against the entire economic and political establishment as the front runner,
right?
Now, no matter what else you want to say, that is a fact of world historic importance. And it says something about the state of disenchantment with politics as usual in the United States. The fact that we've gotten this far is really a testament to the organization and enthusiasm from below, because there's no way you win, even if it's close, there's no way you win in Iowa and New Hampshire without a massive amount of bottom-up energy and organizing, because, you know, we're going up against 7-to-1 television funding against us.
Right.
You know, just the entire establishment continues to smear us. So I think as far as turnout, you did see actually a dramatic increase in youth turnout in Iowa. I believe it was 33% increase of young people under 30. I haven't seen the final numbers for New Hampshire, but what I read last night was that it actually was equal to, or if not the highest turnout in the history of New Hampshire. And so I do think part of the difficulty is that Bernie and our campaign are turning out new people, you know, people of color, young people. But there is, I think, a malaise amongst some of the other voters and other campaigners because it's such a crowded field. So I think there is kind of a wait-and-see attitude amongst a certain sector of the primary. And so I don't think that that dynamic would be replicated in the general. I think that what we'd see in the general is Bernie continue to bring out young voters, people of color, working-class voters, and some of the more traditional Democratic voters who hate Trump will vote as well. So I'm not actually very worried about that. What I'm worried about right now is how do we keep up the momentum, because the attacks are just going to keep on coming. And yes, so we just need to be able to out-organize them.
Right. And that's really the big thing. And even just the media, you know, trying to constantly downplay the significance of these wins and the power of the momentum, they want you to dampen that energy so you're not knocking on doors, making phone calls and contributing if you can. And just staying absolutely ruthless and relentless is the only way it happens.
Yeah, I think you need to inoculate yourself. You know, right, in the union movement, that's what we call it, when you both for yourself and then for your coworkers, you basically have to explain what the boss's tactics are. And the boss's tactics are fear and intimidation and to try to grind you down. And so I think a lot of people, even on the campaign and people who are volunteers, were a little shell-shocked after Iowa. You know, we knew the attacks were coming, but then just to see it so blatant, you know, it could be paralyzing, but you need to work through that paralyzation and understand this is going to continue to come, and despite that, we're going to win.
Absolutely. Single-payer health care. We'll speak broadly here, but it's been something that Joe Biden actually first tried to weaponize. Now Pete Buttigieg is going very strong in this notion that somehow universal single-payer healthcare, solving the problem of the healthcare crisis in a structural way, is somehow antithetical to rebuilding a bruised and beaten labor movement in this country. Explain to us why that's wrong, and then what would single-payer healthcare actually do for the union movement in the United States?
Yeah, the reality is that the reason establishment Democrats are attacking single-payer Medicare for All has nothing to do with them wanting to rebuild the labor movement, or nothing to do with their supposed desire to help union members keep their health benefits. These are the same politicians who are getting funded by the billionaires who are literally attacking unions, who are literally trying to roll back and prevent healthcare rights for the rest of the population. So there's a level of cynicism that I think is just we need to foreground from the beginning. It's not about a debate over the best way to provide health care for all. What it is about is trying to use a cynical ploy to try to fight against the one measure that could actually prevent, that could actually implement the healthcare we need for all citizens, all people in this country. And so what Medicare for All, single payer, would do for the labor movement, the first thing we should say is that it would not take away the healthcare plans and healthcare benefits of union members. This is the big bugaboo that keeps on going thrown out there, but it's just not true. Actually, what Medicare for All would do is not only expand the great wins that have been won by union members to the rest of the working class, for many union members, it would actually be a dramatic increase because you're talking about dental health, dental vision, all sorts of added benefits that a lot of union members don't currently have. So it's not taking away your current doctor. It's not taking away your current plan. But the big reason why it's so important, I think, is first of all, by taking healthcare off of the bargaining table, what that means is that you can have the union movement finally start fighting for the rest of the things that we don't have because we've been fighting for so long just to maintain healthcare, which in every other country is guaranteed as an industrialized country, at least, is guaranteed as a right. So you have anyone who's ever been on a union bargaining team just knows that you spend half of your time trying to fight for to maintain or to get a little bit better healthcare benefit. And so from the second you don't have to do that because it's guaranteed, what that means is that you can fight for better working conditions. You can fight for better wages. You can fight so that your union resources aren't going towards just this rear guard defense of your current health benefit plans, but you can start organizing new workers, right? And I think that ultimately, if the labor movement is going to get beyond where we're at right now, which is at our lowest number of members in history, as far as percent of the working population, the only way you're going to build a strong labor movement is if the unions not only fight for their own members, but fight for the whole working class. And Medicare for All is the single best way that the labor movement can place itself as part of this broad political revolution at the head of it and say, look, unions are fighting for all working people. And the way we're going to prove that right now is we're going to win you all health care. For that 90% of workers who right now aren't covered in a union, don't have health care packages like some of us do, we are going to make sure that you join us. And that's how we're going to all move forward together.
And when unions do that, when unions go outside of, you know, very, very sort of narrow sets of interests and relationships, which the enemies of working people have always been able to weaponize to smear and lie about the entire labor movement. But when labor unions don't make that mistake and they don't go insular and they don't just kind of build into small patronage networks, when they go out from that, as an example, the incredible courage of the Chicago Teachers Union going back, particularly in 2012, which I think is another one of these moments that we really need to recognize as the beginning of some type of actual fight back here politically, along with things like Occupy and so on, that when they do that, if they came out and said, our fight is for us and it's also for everybody, one, and I think I just want to underline it, strategically it's necessary for labor because you're taking the major threat off of the table from the boss, which is taking away your health care. And then secondly, you reinforce the rest of the country and the rest of the working class. Look, this is for all of us. This isn't like some sort of narrow club that looks out for itself. It's about the entirety of us, you know, against the bosses.
Yeah, I mean, think about every single time there's a strike or every single time unions want anything, what is the line of the corporate media? What is the line of the boss? It's that these are greedy workers just fighting for themselves, right? And so everything we need to do push back against that has to be foregrounding, particularly at this moment in U.S. history when our movement is so weak, foregrounding that we're fighting for all working people. And you can't do that if you pit your perceived interests against the rest of the working class. The irony here is that even for union members themselves, Medicare for All would be a big benefit, right? It's not like actually you have to make a sacrifice for yourself so that other workers can do better. You know, an injury one is an injury at all. It's not just a slogan, but it has a material basis, which is to say that actually when the rest of the working class is better organized, has more rights, that is going to make you stronger too, because there's always a race to the bottom under capitalism. So the more that you can raise the bottom up, that means that there's less pressure on you to be able to give up, you know, what you've won. And so we do have a dramatic moment, I think, a juncture for the labor movement right now. Bernie's movement shows that there's an appetite amongst a ton of people in this country for really dramatic change in course. And it's up to the union movement to decide whether it's going to be fully on board with that. I think one of the exciting things that has gotten lost in some of the recent media-infused drama is that actually Bernie has more labor endorsements than every other candidate. Not only that, he has more union endorsements than all of the other candidates combined. I was making a list. I think it's at 25 union endorsements right
can
now.
Can we get some
of the most progressive.
Yeah. Sorry, just telling the...
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so, and not only is his list of endorsers so high, but you have some of the most important, most militant unions in the country. You're talking about National Nurses Union. You're talking about United Teachers of Los Angeles. You're talking about Unite Here locals all across California who represent hotel and service workers who are in a similar situation about fighting for their health care but also expanding it. So I think it's really, you know, these unions are showing what I hope the rest of the labor movement does, and it's not too late. If there's pressure from below and the movement continues to grow, I think you're going to see more and more unions continue to get on board the Bernie train.
29 unions for Sanders, 9 for Biden, 4 for Warren. That's exactly the point. All of the most militant and serious ones, obviously, for Sanders. Eric, final thought real quick. I believe, is it correct that you just arrived in Nevada?
Yeah, I just got here last night.
All right, well, here's the classic cable news question. Like, how's it looking? How's it feeling?
Yeah, I think we're going to win Nevada. The big story of the Bernie campaign this year and that we're already seeing on the ground is that really the base of how we're going to win is working class people of color. And in Nevada, unlike Iowa and New Hampshire, you have a large number of those types of communities. So I'm really excited actually to see just how much organizing we're going to do and how much we're going to win by. You know, it's not going to be easy. There's a lot of attacks. But if there's one place where I think it could happen, places like Nevada, California, this is really the bastion of what it's going to take for to put Bernie into the White House.
Eric Blanc, as always, appreciate your time. Everybody go buy a copy of Red State Revolt, really important book about the grassroots uprisings and strikes across so-called Red State America, or maybe a precursor to Red State America. And he's also a national surrogate for the Bernie Sanders for President campaign. Eric, thanks a million.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Michael.
Take care. All right, folks. We're going to have to be done by 2 today. Because of some scheduling things. So we'll get to the fun half quickly. Got a bunch of sound to get to. Become a member of the Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolates. On the Michael Brooks Show last night, Malaika Jabali and Crystal Ball. The title of the episode is Establishment Meltdown in 3, 2, 1. We went deep. The only worthwhile thing about the blemish on our society and democracy about Mike Bloomberg's candidacy is the ability to go deep into his record and deep into the 1% horror show that he inflicted as a door to understand basically neoliberal authoritarianism. So I think that's important. We also went over the state of the race, why Bernie Sanders is the front runner and you should be optimistic, and a whole bunch of other things. This Sunday, Matt Karp and I went deep on the election, the historical context, and what Bloomberg really represents in terms of democracy and the end of it. Next week, vacation, obviously, but new, never-before-seen conversations with Adolph Reed Jr. and Aaron Bastani. Grab your tickets April 3rd, the North Door live show in Austin with Anna Kasparian and Abby Martin, and become a patron for the whole thing, patreon.com/TMBS. All right, guys, what else?
This week on the Antifada, we have a brand new episode of Prolit Cult, producer AP Andy's side project about space, sci-fi, the paranormal, and the Parapolitical. In this episode, he speaks with Joseph L. Flatley, the investigative journalist behind the so-called Prophet from Pittsburgh podcast. They talk about Gabriel of Urantia and his small UFO apocalypse cult in the desert of Tucson and all the crazy, crazy shit that went on with that. It's always an interesting time at Prolet Cult. Also, we still have our episode from last week where Sean goes deep into political economy with a couple of leftcoms that he met on Twitter.com. And it's a really, really good episode for people who want to understand why us crazy commies are always talking about how capitalism cannot continue. They go into great detail. It's good, folks.
Capitalism, not good.
Not folks. Good. Very bad. Oh, also, I forgot to mention, some people were asking me if they could give me money to fund my trip to New Hampshire with three other people. The answer is yes. I want to thank everybody who already donated money to us. And my Venmo is Jamie-Peck. If you want to, is that allowed? Am I allowed to do that? We spent all our own money on it. People wanted to give us money.
It's an FCC violation.
And then I'm probably going to go to Massachusetts during our week off. So if I end up with any extra money, I'm going to donate it to the Bernie Sanders campaign. But thank you so much to everybody who helped support our trip.
Awesome.
Robert O. Paxton, in his Anatomy of Fascism, cites the Klan as one of the early instances of fascism. But in the most recent episode of Literary Hangover, we talk about Nathaniel Bacon's Rebellion and how I think that is sort of like a proto-fascist event. Basically, he exploited the economic anxiety of the indentured servants and slave classes and the, middle class of minor planters against the globalist monopolist governors. Some people like to cite it as an example of a sort of a cross-racial rebellion, and it is one, but the thing that unified them was they wanted to murder Native Americans and take the land. So not exactly the best.
Not the wokest.
Yeah, not a woke rebellion at all. And
actually maybe a woke rebellion.
No, Bacon was a bad, bad guy.
So oh, no. I mean that in a bad way.
Oh, right.
Maybe a...
Gone so far around again.
Yeah, got so far.
Anyway, so a lot of people are checking that out on the patreon.com/literaryhangover page.
All right, folks, there's a problem with the IMs. I'll see if I can figure it out, but we're going to go to the fun half, and we will see you there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27, 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
Unbelievable.
This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off. No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.